I met Chris at a park in Manhattan. Tell me what your nickname is.
C-Black. So that's the shortness of first and last name.
Chris likes good bottled water, the Mets, the Knicks, and the Jets in that order, and chocolate.
Wow, that was a Butterfinger I was eating when you approached.
Chris has a daughter who just finished her second year of college.
Carry her picture right on my phone, too.
Oh, is that her high school graduation robe?
Uh-huh.
Does it say valedictorian?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He's been helping her out a bit, putting some money in her pocket, but she treated him to lunch today.
For the past 8 years, I think, I've been paying her phone bill and my phone bill. And now she, because I'm in this situation, she actually paid the phone bill for us. You know, I think I did a good job raising her. You know, so that's a good feeling.
Chris became homeless a month and a week ago.
Actually, I was on a train for 2 nights before I got into the system. Yeah, that's not too good. Because I didn't know about the hotels.
The hotels. Chris checked into a hotel in Manhattan a couple days ago, and all the rooms at this hotel are completely occupied by men who are homeless, paid for by the city.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Sally Helm.
And I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Today on the show, we look at how New York City ended up renting thousands of hotel rooms for the homeless.
Also, how solving homelessness might be surprisingly cheap, and how the first step in solving it is learning how to count.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened, to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies, from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
People in New York City have what's called a right to shelter.
That means New York City is legally obligated to find a bed for every person who needs one. Every single adult, every family, every couple, every night of the year. If the shelters are full, people cannot be turned away. So the city rents blocks of hotel rooms, entire floors, entire hotels, just for the homeless.
Some are sort of like a shelter-hotel hybrid. Some are five-star hotels with paying customers on some floors and homeless families on others.
The hotel Chris is at doesn't allow him to have any visitors, so I couldn't get in.
Actually, I have pictures you want to see.
Sure.
So this is right. Your windows right overlooking a park?
Mm-hmm. And that's my bed there. And
but
so,
this bed doesn't look like a hotel bed.
No.
Like, it's not hotel furniture.
Right up here is the headboard of what they had, I guess, a queen or king size. The headboard is still up there, but everything else was taken away so they could put these two cots, is what I call them.
Yeah, they're cots.
Yeah.
There's
twin bed on metal.
Oh, so they removed the official hotel furniture.
The hotel that Chris is staying at is a big hotel chain. You've heard of it.
You've seen signs from the side of the freeway. But we're not going to name the hotel.
Because the city told us that in the past, when people have found out that certain commercial hotels are housing the homeless, those hotels dump the homeless guests overnight, leaving the city scrambling to find new hotel beds for them.
All the hotel rooms the city uses are technically shelters, with the rules of a shelter. You have to be in by 10 p.m., and you can't be in the hotel during the day.
Yeah, if you're not working, you have to be out between the hours of 9 to 5. As far as food and drink, water. You can't bring anything else in. There are ways you can sneak some candy bars in. They check your socks, but if you take the candy bar and put it in the back of your sock, they don't check that.
And at this hotel, it's two strangers to a room. They each get a locker for their stuff, because they're strangers. And Chris says his roommate is a big snorer who keeps the room too cold.
And his bed, your roommate's
yeah,
bed?
Yeah, his is on a, by the window.
Oh, very close to each other. Does it feel like a hotel?
Well, actually, it does. You do get the some service there. You get the linen. That changed. But the inside is looks like a hotel.
Last year, the city spent $364 million, about $1 million a day, using hotels as shelters. And of course, it spends even more money on traditional shelters.
Yeah, the city has to do this by court order. Right to Shelter has been around since 1979.
A group called the Coalition for the Homeless was behind the Right to Shelter. But even they say that things have turned out kind of weird. Giselle Ruthier with the Coalition says they never thought it'd come to hotel beds.
It's far cheaper to provide housing, and not only is it cheaper, it's a more humane thing to do. It just makes logical, financial, and moral sense.
Housing. It costs about $40,000 a year to shelter a single adult like Chris in New York City. And Giselle says that is so much more than what it would cost to help Chris rent an apartment, basically double the cost of renting him an apartment.
As the city is now spending a greater and greater share sheltering tens of thousands of people, they need to be thinking about solutions to start housing people so that they can not be spending billions of dollars on shelter costs in perpetuity.
And cities all over the country spend huge amounts on temporary shelter, even though housing is often cheaper than shelter. Not always. We're going to get into some of the nuances in a minute. Either way, Chris says he wants out.
I got to go. I can't stay, you know. So I do everything I can to get out of the system.
Chris misses cooking in a kitchen.
Now, I'm not a Chef Ramsay, but I like to cook my own meal. My meals are 20 minutes or less.
What do you miss cooking?
Spaghetti and tomato sauce.
And the city, they get it. They say, yeah, these hotels are expensive. So they're phasing out commercial hotel use, but it'll still take 5 years. And they're investing more in permanent affordable housing.
So, how should the country spend money to address homelessness? There was one study in the 1990s that really changed the way people think about this, and that's our next story.
First, a little context. Homelessness really comes on the scene as the crisis it is now in the 1970s and 80s. And at the time, the president, Ronald Reagan, thought the market would solve homelessness, that the free market would create low-quality housing for the poorest. So the government shouldn't have to pay for shelters and housing. So Reagan cut funding substantially.
But by the 1990s, homelessness is getting worse, and advocates are pointing out how expensive homelessness itself can be. There'd be flyers all over the subway about this.
You know, the price of a jail cell, $58,000. The price of a hospital bed, $140,000. The price of a shelter, $30,000. The price of an apartment, $11,000, you know.
That's Dennis Culhane, a professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's done research on homelessness, and he knows at this time that most people experiencing homelessness are people like Chris, people who will need a little bit of help for a little bit of time before they get back on their feet.
And that there's really just a small group of people who will be homeless for years, maybe forever, people with addiction and mental health issues, the chronically homeless.
People who are chronically homeless spend a lot of time bouncing around between shelters, emergency rooms, getting hospitalized, and getting arrested and going to jail.
And Dennis wanted to find out, what costs more? Paying rent for the chronically homeless, giving them housing assistance, or keeping things how they are, letting them stay homeless? He follows 10,000 people who were chronically homeless over 8 years.
So you wanted to see, how often are homeless people using shelters, going to the ER, going to jail, if they live on the street compared to if they live in a house that is being paid for by the state and the city?
That's exactly what we did.
And when he added up their jail and shelter and hospital stays, he found that those same dollars could have actually solved the problem, could have gone toward paying their rent and getting them off the street. And he found that if you have a house, you're actually less likely to cycle in and out of jails and hospitals and shelters.
So given all that, it was almost a break even. Technically, it was $1,000 more per year to pay rent for this group of people. But Dennis also didn't look at a bunch of other costs associated with homelessness.
We did not include the costs of emergency medical transport, which turns out to be a very big number. And had we included that, we probably would have been better than break even. There would have been a positive return on investment.
Dennis's study has been replicated dozens of times, and every time it finds the same thing. It costs about as much to house people who are chronically homeless as it does to not house them.
Were you surprised at what you found?
I will say I was surprised that we got so close to break even. I am.
Dennis's study looked specifically at a group of people who were considered the least houseable and the least deserving of help, single adults, sometimes with addictions. And his finding was counterintuitive, that the thing that seems the most generous, help them get a house, is basically worth it, financially. Now, it's important to point out that this doesn't necessarily hold for people who are not chronically homeless, people who are just homeless temporarily.
It doesn't always cost us less. But I think if you look at it over the larger population, it can be break even in many cases and even better than break even in some cases as well.
And Dennis's study really changed the tide on homelessness policy in a huge way.
The study comes out in 2002, and it convinces the president, George W. Bush, to make a goal of ending chronic homelessness.
Do you remember when that happened?
Oh, yes, I do, quite clearly. It was very exciting, I have to say.
Bush poured $500 million into homeless services after Ronald Reagan had cut almost all of them.
All this extra funding worked. It brought homelessness down to the point where, Dennis says, an end was kind of in sight. But in order for cities to get all of this money, they had to do this weird thing. Which brings us to our final story. The U.S. had really no idea how many homeless people there were on the streets. So the Bush administration told cities and counties, find out.
Every corner of America that wants to receive federal funding for homeless services has to physically count their homeless population, like at night with flashlights and clipboards.
All right, here we go. Homeless count, South Bay Area. 2015.
On a cold night in January every other year, this incredible process begins to count the homeless.
All over the country, thousands of volunteers fan out to physically count every homeless person they see. It's called the point in time count, the PIT. And every city and county does it a little differently.
In Los Angeles, it's a visual count. More than 8,000 volunteers cover every inch of the county, all 4,000 square miles, from 7 p.m. to midnight, shining flashlights behind dumpsters, going into every alley, every public parking lot, abandoned buildings.
How's it going?
Did you count that when they ran across the street?
Yeah, I got it.
You're not in trouble.
Every single block is counted. The beaches, the parks, the dried out riverbeds. Volunteers get a map and a tally sheet, and they just start marking.
Somebody's staying there.
If you see an RV, tally mark. Makeshift campsite, tally mark. In actual person, tally mark.
Is it two individuals?
All these communities send their totals to Washington, where it gets tabulated. And a quick 11 months later, they get the official number of how many people were experiencing homelessness 11 months ago.
And these tally marks are supposed to help determine where funding and resources will do the most good. Cities do not get more funding for having more homeless people. That would create a perverse incentive to have more homeless people. It's more about how fast communities get people out of shelters and into permanent housing, things like that.
One of the volunteer counters is a guy named Jake McGuire. He first did this in Austin.
I got 2 hours of training. It was basically, you know, here's how to use the tally sheet. Here's the map of the area you're going to go. Here's your partner. She has a car. Try to be back by this time, you know.
Jake is now with a nonprofit called Community Solutions. Their whole thing is trying to end homelessness.
Like, we're like in our lifetime, like before we die, like this has to happen. This has to be a problem that goes away.
And these new counts help them realize that the problem wasn't actually that big.
In 2010, the point-in-time count showed that there were 106,000 chronically homeless people in the U.S. Remember, that's the worst form of homelessness, people who are out on the streets for years, who might be sick.
And Jake and Community Solutions were thinking 100,000 people? That's actually a small number relative to other social problems. there are more librarians in the country than there are chronically homeless people.
So they launch a national campaign to, pretty simple, find homes for those 100,000 people who are chronically homeless. And they chose this number based on the point in time count, the tally marks from that night in January.
You're like, okay, this is the number. This is how many people we have who are chronically homeless.
Right.
And then you find out how the country arrived at that number. And right. What do you think?
I think, okay, I guess that's how we do it. Great. Yeah, I never questioned it. Yeah. It took a couple years for me to start to wonder, is this number particularly useful?
Because here's what happened to the 100,000 homes campaign. All these communities came together and found 100,000 homes, actually 105,000 homes.
And we sort of sat back and thought, this is great. We just took care of, you know, 90% of the problem. We're going to see a massive decline in chronic homelessness.
But that didn't happen. The next point in time count showed that chronic homelessness only went down by 20,000 people, not 105,000. So Jake thinks, okay, this point in time count is clearly missing the real picture. Like, maybe we can't just count the homeless with flashlights once every other year.
We needed current information. We needed information that was going to be up to date in real time in every community in the country.
This is how we track other important things like unemployment and jobs.
We want to know every month, like, how is the economy doing? Are we creating new jobs? Is the unemployment rate going up or down? Because our expectation is that if we start to see that number going in the wrong direction, there are people in the federal government and other places who could do something in response to that information if they have it in time.
It's so important for those numbers to be meaningful that economists go back and revise them months later if they're a little off.
Jake thinks the U.S. could be tracking homelessness as often as unemployment and jobs, or like the way we track crime and natural disasters in real time so we know where to deploy resources to minimize the damage.
So they set out to create a database of every single person experiencing homelessness, not a tally, a name, and a survey, one that's updated at least twice a week. Real-time homelessness data. And big cities with huge homeless populations like New York and LA are like impossible.
Like, oh, you couldn't possibly get that kind of data quality in a place this big, which I just think is crazy. Like, we track the flu in real time. We track polio around the world in real time. I mean, of course you can get that kind of, you know, most of the people in LA who are experiencing homelessness are known to somebody already. Like, what would it just take to get all that data in one place?
And they wouldn't just count people. They would talk to them, ask them exactly what their situation was.
I mean, like, how do you do that? You knock on a tent in the middle of the night?
Yeah, sometimes you wake them up. You don't, you know, touch them. You sort of try to call out to them. You'd say, ma'am. Hi, I'm sorry to bother you.
They might ask if they're sick, if they're veterans.
And do you ask, like, are you addicted to drugs?
Very personal questions.
So you do ask that.
It's extremely sensitive, yeah.
And they want to know this because a lot of communities have money that's specifically earmarked to help people struggling with substance abuse or health problems or if they're veterans. So if they know this, they can connect people better.
Say, okay, what do we know about this person? What do they need? What would it take to get them housed? What's the plan? Next week, is that person housed? If not, what do they still need? Okay, what's the plan?
They've done this in 69 communities. Bergen County, New Jersey. Rockville, Illinois. Chicago. Jacksonville. Phoenix.
And when Phoenix did this, they found out that Phoenix had about 400 homeless veterans and that they actually had all the federal and local housing subsidies they needed to house all those homeless veterans. It was just about connecting the person to the place.
And this group has actually had more luck ending veteran homelessness than anything else. They've worked with 9 communities who have solved veteran homelessness. And to be fair, they got a lot of help from the federal government. The U.S. spends a lot of money on veteran homelessness specifically.
And 4 communities in the country have ended chronic homelessness overall, at least one without the help of this group and 3 with their help. They say these communities are at functional zero, meaning if you're homeless there, the community can find you a home within a month.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from American Express. You want to build your business. They can help build your business with financing solutions for eligible business customers. The powerful backing of American Express. Don't do business without it. Terms apply. Visit americanexpress.com/business.
If you need to be reminded that we're all more connected than we realize, get the StoryCorps podcast and restore your faith in humanity. Uninterrupted conversations between real people about the things that matter most. And this season, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, we're highlighting voices of LGBTQ people across America. Stories from those who lived before Stonewall to today. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
Planet Money has a new email newsletter. It comes to your inbox once a week with an interesting economic insight. You can subscribe at npr.org/planetmoneynewsletter. You should do it at npr.org/planetmoneynewsletter.
Today's show was produced by Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi and Liza Yeager.
Brian Erstadt edits the show, and Alex Goldmark is our supervising producer.
Special thanks to Mary Cunningham. She is a homeless and housing expert at the Urban Institute, and she taught us so much.
If you want to support Planet Money, one way to do it is tell a friend to listen to your favorite episode or rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Sally Helm. Thanks for listening.
What's your go-to candy bar?
Usually Almond Joy.
Almond Joy is not a common favorite chocolate bar.
I've had that since I was young, so I love that.
That's my mom's favorite chocolate. That reminds me of my mom.
The peanuts, the coconut, the chocolate.
Almond.
Yeah, the mix, yes.
The almond,
right.